The Reformation, the fourth talk in a series on church history, was presented by Peter Wieringa on September 27, 2009 at Reformation Fellowship. The copyright for this recording is held by Gutenberg College, Inc., 2009. Gutenberg College is a non-profit organization, and contributions may be made at www.gutenberg.edu. This material may be copied and distributed in whole for non-commercial and educational purposes, subject to the inclusion of this introduction. All other rights reserved.
We're going to continue spending some time talking about church history this morning. But before we do that, I wanted to also, I know it's Volunteer Appreciation Day, this group of people is such a funny bunch of people. Because as unorganized as we are as a church, there is still some organization that is required anytime lights are turned on and buildings are opened up and rooms are cleaned and all that sort of thing. So there's always some organization that has to be done. And there are actually two groups of people that are, I'm sure, on the list, but are worth mentioning also. The elder board, I believe, is Bob Blanchard, Ron Julian, and Jack Crabtree. Do I have that right? They're the official elder board at this point. But make no mistake, those guys don't organize anything. They can't organize anything. The real people that organize things are the steering committee, and I'm not even sure who all is on the steering committee. I know that Miffy is, and I'm not sure who else. Miffy, can
just
you?
Me.
Just Miffy. And Miffy does organize things. Okay, all right. Oh, there we go. The list of the steering committee is right here on the back, and that is the Boosters, Dick and Christy, Debbie Chase, Stan Filarski, Chris and Cindy Swanson, Catherine Wallstrom, Chris Campbell, Miffy Davis, Ron and Robbie Julian, and Emily Robinson. So they're the ones that kind of keep things organized. And like I said, it is so funny because as disorganized as we are intentionally. I mean, it's not, that's not unplanned, but there still is organization that is required because people are people. And to get everybody in the same place at the same time for our real purpose, which is to hear the teaching of the word, that takes some organization. So I just wanted to commend those folks as well. So having just stated that our real purpose is the teaching of the word, I am not going to be teaching the word this morning. I'm going to be talking about church history. I had somebody come up this last Sunday after I was through talking, and he wanted to know, I think for good reason, why we were talking about church history. And those of you who have been here for a long time know that basically what we're all about is teaching the scriptures. That's what Reformation Fellowship is all about. That's our purpose. That's our goal. That's why we come together. And when I say we, I'm talking about you. That's why we all come together, is for the teaching of the word. So that's the reason we do that. A couple of weeks of church history is just to give us some background, just to give us some context for where we as a church are today. And what's interesting to me to note, and we'll be talking about this morning as we talk about Martin Luther, what's interesting to note is that the church has all too often not focused on the teaching of the scriptures. All too often, the church as an institution, as an organization, the church has not been involved in teaching the scriptures, but rather has gotten distracted by a million different things. And that's some of what we'll be talking about this morning. But the reason we spend a couple weeks on church history is because we often, one of the famous sayings about history is, those who don't know history are doomed to repeat it. One of the reasons I think it's worthwhile hearing about church history is to see what's gone on over the last 2,000 years of the church, and to see some of the things that the church has done right, some of the things that the church has done wrong, and see what we can learn from those things. So, last week, I had 45 minutes to talk about 1,000 years of church history. This week, I'm going to take 45 minutes to talk about 200 years of church history, so it's getting better. We're going to focus on the period that is known historically as the Renaissance, and we really aren't going to spend much time talking about the Renaissance. What we're really going to focus on today is the life and the story of Martin Luther. But we need to talk just a little bit about what went on during the Renaissance, because that all helped to set the stage for the Reformation. Last week I talked about the fact that by the end of that period that is loosely known as the Middle Ages, and nobody can give you exact dates for the Middle Ages, I'm going to suggest that the Renaissance started somewhere in the early 14th century, early to mid 14th century. So the Middle Ages were, let's say, roughly 400 to 1300 or 1350 AD. But by the time we got to the end of the Middle Ages, the church was without question the most dominant institution in Western civilization. The church, in many respects, controlled most of the, well, certainly the spiritual life. There was no, there was only one church to speak of. There weren't a variety of denominations or churches or anything like that like we have today. The Catholic Church was the only real established religious institution, but it also controlled so much of culture, so much of education. It controlled so much of the economy. The church was by far the biggest, most powerful institution in the Middle Ages. But the church had also become an unbelievably corrupt organization by the end of the Middle Ages. And let me just recap a couple of things that we mentioned last week, but just recap them a little bit because they will come into play when we talk about the Reformation. One of the popes that I mentioned last week was Pope Boniface VIII, whose papacy, he died in 1303. Pope Boniface VIII was the one who issued the papal bull, Unum Sanctum. You know, you just got to love the names like that, a papal bull. You just got to love the way those things end up being called in history. But he issued the papal bull, Unum Sanctum, which declared that there is only one church. There is only one legitimate church, and that salvation can only be found within that church through the participation in the sacraments. Now, that cannot be overlooked, and what I find interesting is that just a couple of years ago, the current pope, I cannot believe I can't remember his name, Pope Benedict, the current pope basically affirmed the Catholic teaching that there is only one church. Now, if I got that wrong, somebody feel free to correct me, because I would not want to get something like that wrong. But my understanding, I remember when he became the pope, that they basically affirmed that the Catholic Church is the only legitimate church. Now, pardon me for stepping on toes, if I'm stepping on anybody's toes today, but in my mind, there's a problem when any church, whether it's the Catholic Church or whether it's some organization as powerful and influential as Reformation Fellowship, when any church declares itself to be the only true church, there's a problem. And yet there are churches, denominations, sects, religious orders around the world that declare themselves to be the only true church. Now, make no mistake, it's our striving, even here at Reformation Fellowship, as I would hope it would be within any Protestant church, within any Christian church, it's our desire, it's our striving to be an expression of some kind of a true church, of what the church is really all about. That's our goal. But the Catholic Church, at the end of early in the 14th century, the Catholic Church declared itself to be the only true church, and there is salvation nowhere but within the church by following the teachings and the practices of the church. But the church at that time was riddled with corruption, and over the next several years became awash in all sorts of other problems as well, such as 1303 was when Boniface VIII died. In 1305, just 2 years later, the papacy was basically taken captive by the King of France. Now, this is one of these oddities of history that just is strange for us to even think about. But what happened was the Pope at that time, upon visiting the King of France, was spending some time in Avignon, and he wasn't allowed to go back to Rome. The King of France recognized that there was enough power, there was enough authority, influence, that he wanted to have the Pope basically under his control, if you will. So there was this period of time from 1305 to 1377 that's known in history as the Babylonian captivity of the church, roughly a 70-year period of time when the papacy was in Avignon. What made things even worse was toward the end of that time, or right after, right at the end of that time, there was a period of time that there were two popes. That period of time was known in church history as the Great Schism, 1378 to 1417, because there was still a pope in Avignon and there was a pope in Rome, because it was recognized that if you're going to be the bishop of Rome, which is what the pope was, you'll remember last week when we talked about the bishop of Rome being Peter was supposedly the first bishop of Rome, and the authority for the pope came from the fact that there was a long line of bishops of Rome that came after Peter. So that authority came from being the bishop of Rome. Well, it's tough to be the bishop of Rome and thus the pope if you're in Avignon. So they had for a while a pope in Avignon, a pope in Rome. There was actually a very short period of time, just a year or two, that there were three popes. So you can see that there's good reason why the church during this time began to fall into disrespect. People would look at it and they would see some of the nonsense that was going on, as well as see other instances of corruption within the church, and the respect for the church began to wane dramatically. Other practices that were going on, some of which I touched on last week, while in Avignon, Pope John the 12th established, one of the corruptions of the church was the practice of simony. I mentioned that last week, where you could sell a church office. Well, what Pope John did was he sort of refined the practice of simony by instituting the practice that if you buy a church office, the first year's revenues from that church office go to the Pope. So there's this ongoing money corruption that goes along with greed and with money. Simony is refined. We find pluralism going on, where people own more than one church office. You might be the bishop of two different cities, or you might be a bishop here, an archbishop here. So there's this buying and selling of church offices and this focus on money that people could see that. They could see what was going on, and they could see that that was not what true spirituality in any sense was all about. There was another practice that came up during this time, and it's the practice of selling indulgences, and we'll talk about this very specifically when we talk about the Reformation. The practice of selling indulgences basically was based on the notion that there was this treasury of merits that was stored up in the heavenlies. There was this treasury of merits whereby those saints, Jesus in particular, was the biggest contributor to the treasury of merits, but those saints who had also lived, who had more merit, if you will, than they needed for their own salvation. Now, I'm not making this up. Those saints who had more merit than was needed for their own salvation, that merit was stored up in a treasury of merits, and the rest of us got to draw on that through a variety of means. Going to a crusade, one of the early crusades, would give one a plenary indulgence. A plenary indulgence is like your get-out-of-jail-free card when you play Monopoly. A plenary indulgence meant that you didn't have to spend any time in purgatory. And again, just a quick recap, and I find myself thinking about rabbit trails as we go through all this stuff. For the church at this time, when you died, you didn't go to heaven or hell directly. You went to purgatory. There was sort of an in-between stage where you, sort of a holding cell, if you will. And in order to get out of purgatory, either a certain amount of time had to pass or you had to in some way draw on that treasury of merits in order to not spend time in purgatory or to lessen the time that you spent in purgatory. Well, drawing on that treasury of merits was one way to do it, and it got to the point that initially the Pope, who had the keys of the kingdom, again, remember our discussion last week about Matthew 16, where Peter supposedly, in Catholic teaching, was given the keys of the kingdom. Well, the church then had the right to give out indulgences for a variety of reasons in order to lessen people's time in purgatory, and it got refined to the point that one could actually basically just pay money. One could do things to gain indulgences or finally simply pay money in order to gain indulgences. And we'll talk more about that a little bit later. But as you can see, there is this ongoing corruption, change of focus, loss of focus in what was true, what was important with regard to the church. Clerical abuses were rampant to the point that, and I mentioned this last week, the clergy that was supposed to be celibate, in fact, were known in many, many cases to have concubines, even to the point that the Catholic Church taxed concubinage, taxed those clergy that had concubines. I mean, it got that crazy within the church. So the church in the Middle Ages, shot full of abuses, shot full of problems, and by the time you got to the late 1300s, early 1400s, there was a tremendous popular desire, if you will, for some abuse or for some reform of the abuses of the church. Well, there are a couple of ways that that began to take place. Within the church institutionally, there was the conciliar movement, and I'm only going to talk about that briefly, but the teaching of the church basically was if church councils were good enough in the early years of the church to get the church straightened out and to get the church on track, well, let's have church councils. So there was the conciliar movement, and you can imagine the battle that was going on because the conciliar movement was based on the bishops and the archbishops coming together and challenging or trying to curtail the authority of the Pope. So there was a battle royal going on within the church itself between the bishops and the Pope. The conciliar movement was eventually what ended the Great Schism. The Council of Constance, 1414, 1415, was what ended the Great Schism and the Babylonian captivity and brought the Pope back to Rome. But this showed the decline of the authority of the Pope as the councils and as the bishops and the archbishops began to have more authority. Some attempts to address the abuses within the church, but not very effective. Still tremendous abuse within the church. But there were some individuals, and I mentioned again last week, that there has always been, in my mind, there has always been, in one form or another, a faithful remnant within the church. It isn't as though the church completely, without question, has been corrupt. God has, I would suggest, always maintained a faithful remnant of individuals and in some cases of movements and of churches that remain faithful to the Word of God and remain faithful to pursuing God more than pursuing power and wealth and things like that. Well, in England, during this time, from 1330 to 1384, in England, there was a man by the name of John Wycliffe. I'm going to mention just two individuals. I'm only going to mention them briefly. John Wycliffe in England came at the end, basically, of the Scholastic movement. He had some roots in Scholasticism, but John Wycliffe got it in his head that it was imperative for him to spend more time studying the Bible than to study the church fathers and to study the teachings of the medieval academics, that sort of thing. So John Wycliffe really began a movement for himself and for those who followed him, who were known as Lollards. He began a movement that was focused on studying the scriptures themselves. There's a good reason why Wycliffe Bible translators took that name, because John Wycliffe took it upon himself to work on a translation of the Bible into the English language. That, in and of itself, was revolutionary, to suggest that the Bible would be translated into the vernacular of whatever country people lived in, so that it was accessible to people, so that it wasn't strictly in the domain of the academics and of the clerics to read the Bible, which they didn't do for the most part, but to actually try to put the Bible in the hands of individuals, of people, was revolutionary. It was a huge change in the church. Well, John Wycliffe was one of the first ones to do that. John Wycliffe died a peaceful death in 1384. Not true of John Huss. John Huss was a Bohemian reformer. His dates are 1372 to 1415. John Huss got wind of some of Wycliffe's ideas, began to have some interest in Wycliffe's ideas, began to teach and preach things that then put him in conflict with the church, began to question the abuses of the church, began to question some of the teaching, some of the dogma of the church, and wanted to reform the teaching of the church as well. So John Huss is going about doing this in Bohemia, and John Huss is called on the carpet for his teachings, is challenged, is anathematized by the Pope, and is called to the Council of Constance in 1414, 1415, I can't remember just which, must have been 1415. He was called to the Council of Constance in order to defend his teachings, in order to tell the church why he was teaching what he was, and to show why he shouldn't be condemned as a heretic. And he was promised safe passage, which was important because Bohemia was already resistant to the influence of the focus of the church, which was in southern Europe. And you begin to see here some geopolitical concerns that come into place also. The Bohemians didn't want the Italians and the French and everybody else messing too much with their affairs, and so there was already a tension there. John Huss was given the promise of safe passage. He could come to the council safely. He could leave safely. He just had to come and defend himself. Well, once he got there and expressed his beliefs, expressed what he had to say, they basically retracted his safe passage, and John Huss was burned at the stake in 1415. That's what happened in the Middle Ages, in the Renaissance. That's what happened in many cases to those who challenge the authority of the church. Then what I think is one of the odder events of church history was that the Council of Constance also ordered that John Wycliffe's bones be dug up and burned, and they were. That's how seriously they took this whole notion of heresy. So you see these struggles beginning to erupt into the open between those reformers who wanted to change the church and who wanted to see some reform of the abuses, some correction of the abuses, the tension that was growing between them and the church itself. Well, there was also, during this time, a rise of almost an academic movement, but it was a cultural movement as well. There was the rise of humanism that was going on in Europe at this time, and there were two streams of humanism that I just want to mention in passing. One was Italian humanism, the other was Christian humanism in Northern Europe. But humanism, as we usually think of it, was the movement, the biggest movement behind what was going on during the Renaissance. It was the movement behind the artistic artistic movement that was going on during the Reformation, the academic movements, linguistic movements, and for our purposes, one of the biggest parts of the humanist movement was to tell people that it was important to go back to the original sources. If you wanted to understand something, it was important to go back to the original sources rather than simply read commentaries upon those original sources. Well, that's the sort of idea that Gutenberg College is based on, that it's important to go back to and read the original sources rather than read all the intervening literature. And for academics within the or during the Renaissance, that was absolutely revolutionary, because you began to see that what was being taught by the church wasn't necessarily true. For example, and this was just a one instance during the Renaissance, back in around somewhere around 800, a document appeared in the Western Church. A document appeared called the Donation of Constantine. The Donation of Constantine was supposedly, it was an actual document that supposedly had been written by Constantine when he brought his court to the East. He wrote this document that gave to the Bishop of Rome authority both spiritually and civilly in the West. The idea was that because Constantine was going to be in the East, there needed to be some authority in the West. That authority was given by Constantine to the Pope, or to the Bishop of Rome at that time. That would have been in the 4th century that supposedly took place. Well, this document was just sort of turned up, if you will, around 800, and it was accepted for the next 300, 400, 500 years. It was accepted as a valid document until within the Renaissance, until the humanists began to focus on studying original sources. And as they studied the Donation of Constantine, they discovered, oh, this document uses words that simply didn't exist when Constantine was around. This document, they were able to show linguistically, to show that this document was a forgery. Well, that just, again, raced through the Catholic Church at that time. That caused increasing problems with the church. It was the humanist movement, with its focus on studying the original sources, on getting to the bottom of things, that began to erode some of that authority of the church during the Renaissance. And then just very briefly, in Northern Europe, there was a movement called Christian Humanism. Some of the personalities, there's probably one that, just one personality that you would perhaps know of. It's, I've forgotten his name. Well, now Erasmus I was going to mention, but The Dark Night of the Soul was written by St. John of the Cross. I think it was St. John of the Cross. No, that isn't what I'm thinking of. I'm thinking of somebody else. Anyway, there were a couple of individuals. Erasmus was the most notable Christian humanist. There were a couple of individuals in the north who drew on some of these same principles that the Renaissance in the South drew on, and that is studying things in the original languages, studying the original sources, drew on some of those same ideas and principles, but in a Christian context. And so there you see a much more Christian, if you look at and read the humanists in the South, they really didn't pay much attention to the church, quite honestly. The church was not their focus, and theology was not their focus, whereas in the North, the Christian humanists were much more focused on those things. Erasmus, as John said, was the most notable of the Christian humanists. He's going to come into play here in a little bit when we talk about the Renaissance, but part of the movement of the Christian humanists in the North was the movement to reconstitute, if you will, the Greek New Testament. That's what Erasmus worked on, to pull back together the Greek New Testament so that the New Testament could be studied in its original language rather than the Latin Vulgate version that everybody was using at the time. So Erasmus pulls together the Greek New Testament. Reuchlin began to pull together the Hebrew Old Testament with a focus on, and to us, you see, we don't think twice about this because that's the sort of thing that we do here at Reformation Fellowship, but this was radically new and different for the church at that time to begin to focus on studying and understanding the scriptures in their original language, in the Greek and the Hebrew. Well, that just gives you some background. Now, let me talk a little bit more specifically about what was going on with Martin Luther. Understand that by the time Martin Luther came on the scene, Martin Luther was born in 1483. By the time Luther came on the scene, there were all sorts of political tensions around Europe. There were there was the beginning of the evolution of different nations that were beginning to take form in much more the way we understand them today. Germany at that time was not really a nation per se, but France and Spain were becoming more identified individually as nations, even more than they had been in the past. And there was all sorts of jostling and struggles for power during Europe at this time. And the Germans up north, really, I mentioned this with regard to John Huss, the Germans did not want the rest of Europe messing with them. The Germans really wanted to be able to establish their own identity, to be able to be on their own more. So there's this political struggle that was going on that in many respects opened the door for the Reformation, because if there had been the same sort of iron hand across all of Europe that, say, Innocent III had — I mentioned Innocent III last week — Innocent III basically could pull the strings of every temporal ruler across Europe. Well, if that sort of control had still been in place, the Reformation would have had a much harder time really getting off the ground. But there were all sorts of struggles that were going on in Europe during this time. Well, let me just give you a brief outline of Martin Luther's life, and then I'm going to tell you a little bit about the events of the Reformation. I'm going to read to you out of a biography of Martin Luther. I'm going to read to you some comments about Luther, some comments that Luther made, because what I really hope is that you'll be able to get a feel for the man. Martin Luther was not without fault, but I believe Martin Luther was one of the greatest men of Western civilization. We owe him a great deal in terms of the path that he paved, if you will, for us to focus on studying the scriptures themselves rather than church tradition and church history. Martin Luther was a great man, not without problems, but hugely significant in the history of the church. He was born in 1483. He was born in Erfurt, Germany. He was the son of a miner, and his father had great ambitions for his son. His father wanted him to be an attorney. Luther was following the wishes of his father, went to school in order to be an attorney. In his younger years, he was schooled under the Brethren of the Common Life. The Brethren of the Common Life were a Christian humanist movement. Erasmus was a part of the Brethren of the Common Life. Gerard Groot was a part of the Brethren. He was schooled under the Brethren of the Common Life, so he began to imbibe some humanist principles, Christian humanist principles, insofar as the Christian humanists took them. In 1505, when he was 22 years old, he was traveling. He was on his way back to the University of Erfurt. He was struck by lightning. This is the historical account that he gives for himself. He was struck by lightning, and when that happened, like a true medieval man, he didn't pray to God. He prayed to Saint Anne. Saint Anne, help me. I will become a monk. Now, that's the trade-off of a medieval man at this time. The prayer isn't to God. The prayer is to one of the saints, because there are all these saints that are between us and God that have more merit, have more access to God than we do. So his prayer was to a saint. And not only that, there was sort of this quid pro quo that was suggested. God, if you — well, actually not God, Saint Anne — if you protect me, I'll become a monk. I'll do this really significant, meritorious thing if you protect me. So that was his prayer when he was struck by lightning. He was good to his word. His father didn't like it at all, but he was faithful to his word. He joined the Augustinian monastery in Erfurt. That's the name I was thinking about. Thomas a Kempis, The Imitation of Christ, was also a part of the Brethren of the Common Life, the Christian humanist movement. So Augustine joined the Augustinian monastery. In 1511, he was sent to the University of Wittenberg to teach theology. And here's, again, one of those things that we just don't understand. We think, well, if someone is going to teach theology, they're going to teach the Bible. Well, Luther was sent to teach theology with no concept of what the Bible had to say. He didn't read the Bible. He didn't study the Bible. He taught theology by teaching what theologians taught. So he's doing that in 1512, he received his Doctor Biblius degree, his doctorate in the Bible, and make no mistake, even now he is not reading and studying the Bible. He's received his doctorate in studying what people say about the Bible without studying it himself. But he, under the direction, he, and we'll talk a little bit about some of his personal turmoil, his personal struggles that that were going on in his life. But his superior in the monastery actually encouraged him as he's going through these unbelievable personal struggles. He encouraged Luther to read the Bible. What a novel thought. It was, at that time, it was a very novel idea. So in 1512, he's put in a position to teach the Bible. From 1512 to 1513, he begins teaching the Psalms. 1515 to 1516, he's teaching Romans. And these are the years that, for the first time in his life, as an educated, a very well-educated medieval monk, and I say medieval because this is, he's basically, at this point, at the end of the medieval tradition, if you will, as a well-educated medieval monk, he now, for the first time, is reading and studying the Bible itself. Let me just finish the chronology, and then I'm going to go back and talk a little bit more about him personally. It was in 1517, and that's the date that everybody acknowledges is the beginning of the Reformation. It was in 1517, on All Saints' Day, what is our Halloween day, that he posted his 95 theses on the door of the Castle Church in Wittenberg. And I'll tell you in a minute what that's all about. 1517, and then he died peacefully in 1546. He was not burned at the stake or anything like that. He died peacefully 29 years later. Well, now let me tell you just a little bit more about Luther himself. Luther, again, as a good heir to the medieval church tradition, Luther lived his life in abject fear. That was by far the dominant response that he had to what he understood about who God was. He understood that there was nothing he could do to live up to God's wishes, and that thus his life, because of his lack of understanding of what the scriptures had to say, thus his life was basically hopeless. There was absolutely nothing that he could do to save himself, nothing that could be done. So he lived his life in fear. He believed that if there was something that he could do, it would be to go into a monastery, and it would be to become the best monk he could possibly become. That was his only hope, possibly, of appeasing God's anger. So while he was in the cloister, he was a monk's monk. That's the way he referred to himself. He did everything that was required of him. Let me read to you just a little section. There's a book here by Roland Bainton called Here I Stand, A Life of Martin Luther. I think it's a great book. When my kids were young, I did my best to bribe them to read the book. I don't think any of them ever did, but I actually tried to pay them money to read the book. But if you're interested in church history, and if you're interested in an account of the life of this one man, I think it's a great book. Very interesting. Lots of his own words in here. You get a real insight into who he was. But here are the comments that Bainton makes about Luther during this time, including some of Luther's own words. He says about Luther, he fasted sometimes 3 days on end without a crumb. The seasons of fasting were more consoling to him than those of feasting. Lent was more comforting than Easter. He laid upon himself vigils and prayers in excess of those stipulated by the rule, the monastic rule. He cast off the blankets permitted him and well nigh froze himself to death. At times he was proud of his sanctity and would say, I have done nothing wrong today. Then misgivings would arise. Have you fasted enough? Are you poor enough? He would then strip himself of all save that which decency required. He believed in later life that his austerities had done permanent damage to his digestion. And then a quote from Luther himself. He says, I was a good monk, and I kept the rule of my order so strictly that I may say that if ever a monk got to heaven by his monkery, it was I. All my brothers in the monastery who knew me will bear me out. If I had kept on any longer, I should have killed myself with vigils, prayers, reading, and other work. And then Baton comments, all such drastic measures or methods gave no sense of inner tranquility. The purpose of his striving was to compensate for his sins, but he could never feel that the ledger was balanced. That's the belief of a medieval man, is that somehow or other his goodness had to balance out his badness. Somehow or other he had to do enough good on his own to be able to balance out the badness of his own sin. Well, in 1510, he was sent to Rome on monastery business, and this was before he began to study the scriptures for himself. He was sent to Rome. This was the Rome when Pope Alexander VI was the pope. Pope Alexander VI is better known to us in history as Rodrigo Borgia. If you know your history, you'll know that the Borgias were an unbelievably corrupt family, buying and selling church offices, killing each other in order to attain church offices. Well, the Pope at that time was one of the Borgias, and Rome during that time was unbelievably corrupt. Imagine picking out the most corrupt, decadent city you can possibly imagine. A couple of them come to mind, but imagine the most decadent city you can think of, and that was what Luther walked into when he went to Rome in 1510. Supposedly, the most pious and spiritual city in Europe is in fact the most corrupt. And while he's in Rome, there were things that he could do, places that he could go in order to attain more merit. So I'm not going to. This book is great. You gotta pick up a copy of this book and read it. There's all sorts of stuff in here that I'd like to read to you, but for the sake of time, I won't. But there were places that you could go to in Europe where you could do certain things that would give yourself more merit in order to lessen your time in purgatory. One of them was to climb up the church or the steps of the Praetorium of Pilate, to climb up the steps one at a time on your hands and knees, kissing each step. And that was going to be a meritorious action that would lessen your time in purgatory. Well, when he got to the top of the steps, his response to that was basically questioning, I only wish I knew if it was so. I only wish I knew if there was indeed any merit, any value to this. But he was willing to do whatever he could to try to acquire God's favor by his actions. But all around him, he saw this unbelievable corruption. He goes back to Germany. It was in 1511 that he was sent to Wittenberg. Johann von Staupitz was the vicar of the Augustinian order. Johann von Staupitz was very good for Luther in understanding the turmoil that he was going through, understanding the fear that he was experiencing, and being in some sense a true mentor to him, a true guide to him, and helping him to deal with some of those things. I just have the impression that von Staupitz didn't take seriously much of the formality or much of the dogma and teaching of the church at that time. Well, for Luther, nothing could satisfy him, none of his activities, nothing he could do made him feel as though he was pleasing to God. Let me read this quote from Luther in his own words. He says, "Is it not against all natural reason that God, out of his mere whim, deserts men, hardens them, damns them, as if he delighted in sins and in such torments of the wretched for eternity, he who is said to be of such mercy and goodness. This appears iniquitous, cruel, and intolerable in God, by which very many have been offended in all ages. And who would not be? I was myself more than once driven to the very abyss of despair, so that I wished I had never been created. Love God, I hated him. Well, that's where Luther was coming from in 1511, 1512. Van Staupitz then assigns him to the teaching of the scriptures, assigns him to read Psalms, to read and study and teach Psalms and eventually Romans. And that study revolutionized Luther's life. It changed his life. And I would suggest that for most of us, if we were to identify a time when our lives have been revolutionized, for most of us, it would be that time when we took seriously the study of the scriptures and understanding what the scriptures had to say. True for Luther as he studied Psalms, as he studied Psalm 22 and 23, he began to understand more of what God's righteousness was all about. In terms of understanding God's mercy, he began to see that for the first time as he studied Psalms, as he studied Romans. I could go into quite a bit more detail about what he was saying there and what he was learning, but it was in his study of Romans, as he was studying the early chapters, that we have him coming to the, for him, revolutionary understanding that those who are just, those who are considered righteous by God, are those who live by faith, not by their merits, not by the things that they do to try and acquire God's attention, rather those who live by faith. Well, I can't say enough about what an unbelievable personal journey Luther went on. And sometime there's a movie that came out a few years ago on Luther. It's just entitled Luther, that is, it does really a very good job in many respects of portraying the whole story of Luther and what went on. Sometime it'd be fun maybe to get together with a group of people and watch something like that and discuss it, because there was a tremendous personal battle, personal struggle that he went through that was resolved for him by his study of the scriptures. Now, for a while, that resulted in significant changes in his own life, but that didn't really change much. He didn't take that understanding and immediately take it upon himself to change the world. Remember that he was studying Romans in 1515 and 1516, I think it was. The Reformation didn't take place until a year or two after he came to some of these revelations. But what happened was a conflict was coming down the road toward him that he simply could not avoid. And the story is really, really pretty interesting. So let me try to get it to you as briefly as I can. The University of Wittenberg was entirely supported by Frederick the Wise. Frederick the Wise was himself one of the electors of the Holy Roman Empire. So he was one of the most powerful men in the Holy Roman Empire himself, unbelievably influential, but he was very much a medieval man also. And perhaps Frederick's proudest accomplishment was his acquiring this treasury of relics that could be used as part of this whole process of transferring merits to someone else. So he gathered this whole treasury of Christian relics that supposedly had some spiritual value attached to them. And let me tell you what some of them were, just to give you some idea of what I'm talking about. In his treasury, in his collection of relics, Frederick the Wise had a tooth of St. Jerome, 4 pieces of St. Chrysostom. I've never quite figured out what those pieces would be, but 4 pieces of St. Chrysostom, 6 pieces of St. Bernard, and 4 of St. Augustine. He had 4 hairs from Mary, the mother of Jesus, along with 3 pieces of her cloak, I assume it was her everyday cloak and not her Sabbath cloak, but who knows? He had a piece of Jesus' swaddling clothes. He had parts of Jesus' crib, a straw from the manger. He had some of the gold and the myrrh that the wise men had brought when they came to see Jesus. He had a hair from Jesus' beard, one of the nails from the cross, to go along with a piece of bread from the Last Supper. By 1520, his collection of relics had grown to 20,000 pieces of that sort that were attached either to Jesus or to one of the saints. And that collection of merits was one which, if viewed, if you went through like a museum, if you went through and viewed that collection of relics on appropriate days, you would have rub off on you some of the merits that went along with those individuals, and thus would lessen your time in purgatory. So Frederick the Wise had this unbelievable collection of merits. If one were to, it had grown to 20,000 pieces. If one were to view all of the relics and receive all of the merit that went along with them, it was calculated that it would lessen your time in purgatory by 1,902,202 years and 270 days. Now you can imagine how long one would be in purgatory to have that much time taken off one sentence, but that's what the collection of relics was all about, was in order to impart that merit to other people. Well, then in 1517, and now we're looking at the Holy Roman Empire, in 1517, Albert of Brandenburg, who was the Archbishop of, or wanted to become the Archbishop of Mainz. The Archbishop of Mainz was one of the other seven electors during this time. Albert of Brandenburg wanted to purchase the practice of simony. He wanted to purchase the Archbishop of Mainz. He already was the Bishop of Halberstadt and Magdeburg, so he already had two church offices, but the Archbishop of Mainz would make him the most important cleric in all of Germany. So he wanted to purchase that. The Pope offered to sell it to him for 12,000 ducats, 1,000 for each of the 12 apostles. Albert countered. His counteroffer was 7,000 ducats, 1,000 for each of the seven venial sins. Well, they settled on 10,000 ducats. I'm not making this up. Believe me, I'm not making this stuff up. They settled on 10,000 ducats, and I mean, who knows? I fumbled through some calculations a couple of years ago. It seemed to me, as I tried to reconstruct what ducats were worth at that time, it seemed to me as though that would have been roughly $1 million that he was paying to become the Archbishop of Mainz. Well, he didn't have that kind of money, so he went to a banking family, and he borrowed the money to buy the church office. And then the Pope at that time, Pope Leo, allowed him then to sell an indulgence. This is complicated. This is high finance here. Allowed him to sell an indulgence whereby he could gather money to pay off his loan. Half the money that came in from the sale of those indulgences paid off his loan, and half the money went right back to the Pope. So he was authorized to sell indulgences in order to finance the purchase of the archbishopric there. Well, that resulted in John Tetzel, who was a Dominican friar, and here you get into some of the more familiar parts of the story. John Tetzel would go around Germany at that time selling these indulgences, and the famous little phrase that goes along with John Tetzel is he would go from town to town and understand what's going on here, go from town to town preying on the superstition of the uneducated, preying on their superstition and suggesting to them that simply by contributing money they could receive for themselves or for someone else release from purgatory. So the little song that he would sing as he went around Germany was had the words, "As soon as the coin in the coffer rings, a soul from purgatory springs." You could buy release from purgatory for yourself, for your passed away, your deceased grandparents or great uncle or whoever you wanted to. you could have them released from purgatory simply by purchasing an indulgence. Well, what happened was on All Saints Day in 1517, John Tetzel is coming right up to the borders of Saxony. He wasn't actually coming into Saxony because, understand, there was a conflict here. He's selling these indulgences. Frederick the Wise has his own collection of relics with the indulgences that go along with them. So John Tetzel doesn't come right into Saxony, but many of the people from Wittenberg are going across the border in order to hear John Tetzel, hear what he has to say, and to purchase these indulgences. Well, when Luther looked at that, that for him was the final straw. That was when he saw the superstition of the Middle Ages, the abuses of the church, the decadence, the corruption. That was when everything came to a head. And that was when he wrote his 95 theses that he posted on the door of the castle church. And what he did was he threw down the gauntlet. Now understand, his goal was not to institute a split with the Catholic Church. His goal was the same goal that many others in the Middle Ages had, and that was to reform the Catholic Church. That's what he was trying to do. So he posted these 95 theses, which were basically an opportunity for there to be a discussion and an argument about some of these points to discuss what was true and what wasn't. And it was built around the indulgences, which then got to the authority of the church. Does the church have the authority to remit sins or does it not? So his 95 theses, really, he didn't expect it. He didn't know it was going to happen. But his 95 theses got to the very heart of some of the problems with the authority of the church and the corruption that was going on in the church. The other accident of history, if you will, is that the printing press had been invented 50, 60, 70 years earlier, sometime in the mid-15th century. The printing press had been invented, and so he wrote these 95 theses, and literally within a couple weeks, he just thought this was going to be a little local discussion. It would be as if you or I had posted something on the city hall in Eugene, and we thought we were going to have a little local discussion about these sorts of things. Well, within 2 weeks, his 95 theses had been printed and had spread all across Europe. And with that, a firestorm was ignited, because people could see for themselves the way it challenged the authority of the church at this time. Well, there is a ton more that we can get into, but basically, what I'm going to suggest to you is that what goes on then is a battle between this reform movement and the church, a battle over the authority of the church. Is it the Pope who is authoritative? Or is it the scriptures who are authoritative? Is it church councils that are authoritative? Or is it the scriptures? Is it the creeds of the church, the traditions, the dogma of the church that are authoritative? Or is it the scriptures? That's the battle that was going on at this point that was ignited all across Europe. And Luther was right in the middle of it. And there are just some great stories about Luther's life that I wish we had time to get into, but let me just kind of cut to the chase here, get to the apex, if you will, of what was going on with Luther's reforms. By the time we get to 4 years later, there have been all sorts of discussions. Luther has been condemned. He's been called on to defend his position, and finally, in 1521, he's summoned to the Diet of Worms. Worms is a city. He's been summoned to the Diet of Worms to appear before the emperor, as well as a number of the clergy, to appear in order to defend his beliefs and to state why he believes what he does. And let me just read to you this account of what happened at the Diet of Worms. He is being questioned by an individual that he has known for years and years, John Eck. He's being questioned, challenged, and here's this account of what happens at the Diet of Worms. Eck replied, these are Eck's words, "Martin, you have not sufficiently distinguished your works, He's being asked to reject the things that he has written and to declare that the things he has written are wrong, because in that intervening 4 years, he's written a number of books, pamphlets. His writings have become unbelievably widespread and unbelievably influential. So he's being challenged to reject all of those. You have not sufficiently distinguished your works. Your earlier works were bad and the latter worse. Your plea to be heard from Scripture is the one always made by heretics. You do nothing but renew the errors of Wycliffe and of Huss. How will the Jews, how will the Turks exult to hear Christians discussing whether they have been wrong all these years? Martin, how can you assume that you are the only one to understand the sense of Scripture? Would you put your judgment above that of so many famous men and claim that you know more than they all? You have no right to call into question the most holy Orthodox faith instituted by Christ the perfect lawgiver, proclaimed throughout the world by the apostles, sealed by the red blood of the martyrs, confirmed by the sacred councils, defined by the church in which all our fathers believed until death gave to us an inheritance, and which now we are forbidden by the Pope and the Emperor to discuss, lest there be no end of debate. I ask you, Martin, answer candidly and without horns. Do you or do you not repudiate your books and the errors which they contain? Luther replied, "Since then, Your Majesty," speaking to the Holy Roman Emperor Charles, who was the emperor at the time, "since then, Your Majesty and Your Lordships desire a simple reply, I will answer without horns and without teeth. Unless I am convicted by Scripture and plain reason, I do not accept the authority of popes and councils, for they have contradicted each other. My conscience is captive to the word of God. I cannot and I will not recant anything, for to go against conscience is neither right nor safe. God help me. Amen." And with that, the rift between the Reform movement and the Catholic Church becomes permanent. And there's more that we'll talk about in a couple weeks about what happens in the Reform movement. But hopefully, what I've been able to do today is just to give you a little bit of an insight, specifically into the life of one man who lived most of his life fearing God, fearing that he could not do enough to please God, who then, by his study of the Scriptures, by his understanding of the Scriptures, came to an understanding of God's mercy, came to an understanding of what faith is all about, and as a result, ignited a change which swept across Europe and eventually swept across the world. So, that's the end of Martin Luther. We really don't have much time for questions. If there's maybe one or two pressing questions, we'll try to cover them.
This is really quick. What did Martin Luther study the Bible in the original languages?
Martin Luther studied Erasmus by this time, had translated the New Testament into Greek, and Reuchlin had translated the Old Testament into Hebrew. So as part of the humanist movement, and the Christian humanist movement, he was studying the Bible in the original languages, which made a huge difference over studying it in the Vulgate. So yes, he was studying it in the original Greek and Hebrew. And he, in turn, interesting story, pardon me for rabbit trail here, when he's leaving the Diet of Worms, he is fully expecting that, like John Huss, he's fully expecting that he's going to be taken into captivity, he's going to be burned at the stake. When he's leaving the Diet of Worms on his way back to Wittenberg, he's kidnapped. And everybody thinks that he's been kidnapped by the church and is going to be murdered at that point. In fact, I can't believe it, I almost get tears in my eyes, Frederick the Wise, who had no reason to protect Luther other than God moved him to do so, Frederick the Wise was the one who had Luther kidnapped, brought him off to a castle in order to protect him, and over the next couple of years that he was there, he translated the Bible into German. So the German Bible that he translated, my understanding is that the German Bible basically has shaped the German language ever since that time, and was obviously one of the most influential books in Germany at the time. So he studied it in the original language. He translated it into the vernacular so that the peasants of his day and everybody else, well, the peasants couldn't read, but so that that anybody who could read the Bible in their own language.
Thank you.
What was supposed to have gone on in purgatory? I don't know anything about purgatory, and it seems to me that if everyone goes there before they go to either heaven or hell, that the people who are on their way to hell would not want to get out of purgatory, and therefore they could give their indulgences to the people who, you know, yeah, did want to.
I don't have a clue if they had board games or if they, I mean, I have no clue. I have not looked into that myself as to what went on in purgatory. It didn't seem to be a bad place like hell, but it certainly didn't have, you know, the harps and the clouds and the stuff that they're supposedly waiting for. I'm kidding about that last part.
I was raised a Catholic, and I can tell you the doctrine of purgatory has definitely gone had some evolutions to it. When I had 12 years of Catholic education, and when I was in school, purgatory was supposed to be like hell, only not permanent. Oh. It was a temporary thing. And so, hence you could, and, well, this is sort of a long story, I'll try to make it short, but so you could see the motivation why people would, sure, want to avoid purgatory. And not everybody went to purgatory. If you were sinless, or if you had a plenary indulgence, so your slate was wiped clean just before you died, you would go straight to heaven. Now, if you talk to the Catholic Church, to people, and it's very difficult, actually, I've found it's very difficult to find a consistent answer for what the Catholic Church believes, but they have repudiated that idea of burning. In fact, in their the catechism, the official blessed by the Church catechism, they say it was an unfortunate misunderstanding, such a big misunderstanding, in fact, that Catholics that I talk to now, some Catholics have told me that I was never taught that. That was not the case. And I found...
Did you say about burning?
The burning, yeah.
Okay.
I thought, well, I know what I was taught, and there's all sorts of former Catholics who remember being taught that. Well, I found books with the imprimatur, the official blessing of the Catholic Church, written by archbishops that actually talk about this doctrine. But they've repudiated that, so then you have to ask them, well, so what does go on there? Well, purgatory, purgation is to be purified. You're being purified. Well, how does that happen exactly? You can sort of understand why being burned might purify you. But so they've gotten themselves in this strange situation where they can't tell you why you would necessarily want to get out of... There's no longer burning, so it's not necessarily a unpleasant place. So why would you want to make extraordinary efforts to avoid it? They can't really tell you that. It's a big mess. But I'm guessing at that time they also, the word was that it was like hell except we're not permanent.
Okay, that's helpful. Thank you. Anybody else? Or are we done for the morning? Let's call it a morning. Thank you.